Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica. Te invitamos a que te unas a nuestras redes sociales por Twitter en @info-pacífica o en Facebook bajo el nombre de nuestro productor Fernando Velázquez, Informativo Pacífica.
México fue el segundo país latinoamericano con más ataques cibernéticos en 2016 y el más vulnerable ante el virus WannaCry. Ahora el gobierno dice que está preparando legislación para lidiar con el crimen cibernético. Paula Guzmán amplía la información.
200.000 víctimas en al menos 150 países. Ese fue el resultado del virus WannaCry, un ataque cibernético que secuestraba los archivos de una computadora y pedía una recompensa para liberarlos. De acuerdo al Instituto Nacional de Ciberseguridad Español, en 2016 los países más atacados del mundo fueron Estados Unidos, Reino Unido y España. Pero eso no quiere decir que naciones latinoamericanas están exentas de malware. Tan solo en México, las pérdidas anuales registradas por la OEA se estiman en 3.000 millones de dólares. Fue el segundo país con más ciberataques en América Latina en 2016 y el más vulnerable de la región frente al virus WannaCry. Ante estas amenazas, las autoridades mexicanas enviarán al Congreso en septiembre una iniciativa de ley de tecnología financiera o FinTech, una propuesta basada en 5 ejes, entre los que destacan la protección al consumidor que podría evitar extorsiones como las ocurridas con WannaCry y la prevención del lavado de dinero o financiamiento al terrorismo. Esta ley regulará actividades financieras como el fondeo colectivo o crowdfunding, fondos de pago electrónico o e-money y la administración de activos virtuales como lo es el Bitcoin. La propuesta posiciona a México como uno de los pocos países en el mundo que cuentan con una legislación de este tipo. Analistas aseguran que resulta vital ir estipulando un margen más definido para los negocios en Internet, especialmente cuando estos pronostican que el costo de la ciberdelincuencia en el mundo aumentará a 6 billones de dólares cada año.
En Venezuela localizan el helicóptero secuestrado que perpetró atentados en Caracas. El vicepresidente ejecutivo Tarek El Aissami informó que la aeronave fue localizada en la zona costera de Venezuela. Erika Ortega Sanoja reporta.
Siguen las reacciones tras los atentados terroristas que se cometieron la tarde del martes contra el Ministerio de Interior y el Tribunal Supremo de Justicia venezolanos. Ya se encontró la aeronave que fue utilizada para el atentado. Fue localizada en la población costera y caribeña al norte del país. Se llama Osma y queda en el estado Vargas. La información la suministró el propio vicepresidente Tarek El Aissami en un contacto telefónico para el canal del Estado venezolana de televisión. Este miércoles también reaccionó sobre el asunto el canciller Samuel Moncada. Mostró su indignación porque hasta ahora ningún país europeo haya emitido un comunicado en solidaridad con Venezuela. Tampoco lo hicieron las naciones que han pedido en el seno de la OEA una resolución contra el gobierno de Maduro. Por ello agradeció a Ecuador, Bolivia, Cuba, Palestina y Turquía, además de otras naciones del continente africano que sí mostraron su apoyo con la nación bolivariana tras el ataque.
Un señor se declara guerrero de Dios, secuestra un helicóptero, dispara contra unos periodistas en un edificio, se dirige al Tribunal Supremo, lanza 4 granadas, había población civil alrededor comprando, haciendo su vida normal y corriente, y explotan 3 granadas y huye. Eso en cualquier lugar del mundo es un acto de terrorismo. Sin embargo, nosotros todavía estamos esperando cuál es la reacción de muchos países que dicen preocuparse por Venezuela, se preocupan por los derechos humanos, se preocupan por el pueblo venezolano, se preocupan por la lucha contra el terrorismo, y todavía no hemos tenido la primera declaración.
El presidente del Poder Judicial rechazó el atentado y también lo hizo el ministro de Interior. Él detalló que el piloto es un funcionario desertor del Cuerpo de Investigaciones Científicas, Penales y Criminalísticas. Siguen tras su búsqueda a través de Interpol.
Ya hemos librado orden de captura contra este individuo y su difusión roja internacional a través de Interpol.
Desde el gobierno algunos han dicho que el objetivo final de todo este asunto era iniciar una fase de escalada de la violencia en Venezuela para frenar las elecciones del próximo 30 de julio. Ese día se escogerá a los miembros de la Asamblea Nacional Constituyente que redactarán una nueva constitución. Sobre este asunto habló la presidenta del Poder Electoral. Divisay Lucena se reunió con el vicepresidente, el presidente del Poder Ciudadano y el comandante estratégico operacional de la Fuerza Armada. Y en ese sentido dijo que van a tomar medidas para garantizar que los comicios se lleven a cabo en paz. Lucena llamó además a la oposición a la sindéresis y a permitir el juego democrático.
Si alguna persona, grupos de personas, organizaciones políticas, no están de acuerdo con el proceso, un proceso electoral, están en su derecho, se pueden abstener, como está en la Constitución. El derecho al sufragio es un derecho, no es un deber. Lo que no se puede es impedir un proceso constitucional, impedir un proceso electoral.
Entre tanto, la oposición participaba en el llamado trancazo nacional. En Caracas, el llamado mostró poca gente. La lluvia, en verdad, no dejó que esto se produjera con contundencia. El chavismo también estuvo en la calle, pero en los alrededores del Palacio de Miraflores para defender al gobierno de Maduro. Según dirigentes del chavismo, el silencio de la oposición sobre el atentado es cómplice y ensordecedor.
Los sindicatos de salud pública protestaron frente al Ministerio de Economía en Uruguay para que se tomen en cuenta sus necesidades en el presupuesto nacional. Piden que se incluyan mejoras salariales y creación de nuevos cargos. Eugenia Rodríguez amplía la información.
Trabajadores de la salud pública de todo el país realizaron un paro de 24 horas y se concentraron frente a la sede de la Presidencia de la República para marchar hacia el Ministerio de Economía. Piden que se incluyan mejoras salariales y creación de nuevos cargos en la rendición de cuentas que envió el Poder Ejecutivo al Parlamento.
Contemplado de los pedidos de los trabajadores no hay nada. De lo que había pedido el organismo hay contemplado muy poco tampoco, también. Creemos que es una vergüenza que el gobierno no atienda la salud del pueblo como es debida, creando más cargos de personal y mejorando los salarios para que los trabajadores se queden en el sector público y no vayan al sector privado.
Los bajos salarios hacen que los médicos prefieran trabajar en la salud privada, deteriorando el servicio que se presta a la población más vulnerable, que es la que usa la salud pública. Parte de este reclamo es que se redistribuyan los recursos en forma más equitativa entre los diferentes sectores.
9% del PBI se destina en el recurso para el Sistema Integrado Nacional de Salud. Es cómo estamos redistribuyendo estos recursos y de cómo podemos tener herramientas tan importantes hoy, pedirle a especialmente al Parlamento esas herramientas, leyes que acrediten lo que es la movilidad de los recursos, la mirada de equidad entre el sector público y el sector privado.
El Sindicato del Hospital Vilar de Bó, el Centro de Referencia Nacional de Salud Mental, apoya los reclamos generales y denuncia enormes carencias de todo tipo, desde edilicias hasta falta de agua caliente.
El Hospital Vilar de Bó hoy en día cuenta con una faltante de recursos humanos, donde muchas veces tenemos un enfermero para 30 pacientes, ¿verdad? Donde muchas veces tenemos un licenciado para 70 u 80 pacientes, donde tuvimos una carencia de insumos, ¿verdad? Donde durante mucho tiempo, durante un fin de semana y unos días, no tuvimos frutas, verduras, donde nosotros reivindicamos sobre el agua caliente, ¿verdad?
¡Luz del pueblo uruguayo!
También se rechaza la tercerización de servicios dentro del Estado, que entienden es una forma de precarización del trabajo.
Con este paro de los funcionarios de la salud se cierra un mes de junio marcado por las protestas en reclamo de mejoras presupuestales de parte de diferentes colectivos. El Poder Ejecutivo ya envió su ley de presupuesto al Parlamento, pero aún así se espera un mes de julio también plagado de manifestaciones. Eugenia Rodríguez para Telesur, Montevideo, Uruguay.
La izquierda francesa comienza a organizarse para mostrar rechazo a las reformas del presidente Macron dentro y fuera del Parlamento. Rafael Cuesta, del colectivo radial Más Voces, tiene los detalles.
Las elecciones legislativas francesas han dejado tras de sí una fuerte mayoría para el presidente Macron, pero también un buen número de caras nuevas en la Asamblea Nacional. Es el caso del director de cine y periodista independiente François Ruffin. El diputado del partido de izquierda, la Francia Insumisa, convocó el lunes una concentración y asamblea popular contra el poder antidemocrático del mundo de las finanzas y la política del nuevo mandatario francés.
Al principio la oposición a Macron va a ser difícil. La reforma laboral se va a hacer en verano. El problema es que la gente quiere irse de vacaciones y no piensa en manifestarse. Las elecciones acaban de celebrarse y el gobierno tiene muchos apoyos, además de un grupo parlamentario arrollador y muy dócil. Así que Macron tiene ventaja.
Acompañado por sindicatos y varios diputados insumisos, Ruffin aprovechó para reflexionar junto a los asistentes sobre la estrategia a seguir por los diputados de izquierda en la Asamblea y fuera de ella. Ruffin también es conocido en Francia por haber iniciado el movimiento Nuit Debout, similar al de los indignados españoles. Entre los participantes al acto de Ruffin estaba André Chassaigne, diputado del Partido Comunista Francés.
Tenemos que atacar frontalmente al gobierno para oponernos a las medidas de retroceso social que quiere realizar. Así que los diputados van a necesitar mucha fuerza de voluntad, sin olvidar que por sí solos no valen nada. Detrás suyo debe haber un movimiento social amplio.
Una de las participantes, que forma parte del movimiento Nuit Debout, señaló que dado que la izquierda no va a tener mucho peso en el Parlamento, habrá que apoyar muy activamente en las calles.
Creo que nosotros tenemos que organizarnos para hacernos oír en la calle, porque no tienen muchos diputados en la Asamblea. Pero por eso mismo, tenemos que apoyarlos en la calle. Quizá la gente que ha venido hoy va a proponer ideas interesantes para que nos organicemos mejor.
Las elecciones presidenciales y legislativas han dejado un panorama político inédito en Francia, en el que Macron ha conseguido su objetivo de dinamitar a los partidos tradicionales. Grupos como la Francia Insumisa comienzan a preparar su oposición a las reformas dentro y fuera del Parlamento.
En Honduras, grupos comunitarios conmemoran el octavo aniversario del golpe de Estado contra el presidente Manuel Zelaya. Hilda Silvestrucci reporta.
Este día, en conmemoración al octavo aniversario del golpe de Estado en Honduras, el Frente Nacional de Resistencia en Tegucigalpa ha convocado a plantones pacíficos al final de la tarde en el monumento a Isis Obed Murillo, que justamente queda frente al Aeropuerto Internacional de Toncontín, donde fue asesinado este joven de 17 años el 5 de julio de 2009. Recordemos que Isis Obed se convirtió en la primera víctima violenta del golpe de Estado en Honduras. Ahí justamente se va a rendir tributo a los mártires de la resistencia, y además de esto también se van a hacer algunos eventos culturales para acompañar, para conmemorar y para pedir justicia por estos asesinatos que se han cometido desde ese día hasta la fecha de hoy. Además de esto, se está convocando a jornadas de solidaridad con los estudiantes universitarios que están atravesando por una grave crisis de criminalización y persecución en defensa de la educación pública superior en Honduras, y que se considera parte de esta lucha que se ha enarbolado después del golpe de Estado. Recordemos que a raíz de esto ha venido un proceso de privatización de las empresas públicas, un proceso de concesión de los territorios que se ha agudizado a raíz del 28 de junio de 2009 en el país. Así es que varias actividades centradas en esta situación de violencia, criminalización y violación a los derechos humanos que siguen tan vigentes como ese día 28 de junio de 2009 en Honduras.
Al menos 24 cadáveres de migrantes han sido encontrados en las costas de Libia. Al parecer forman parte de las miles de personas que tratan de alcanzar Europa en embarcaciones precarias, y se calcula que en 2016 murieron un promedio de 13 cada día mientras intentaban la travesía. Por otro lado, la Agencia de Migraciones de Naciones Unidas informa que desde el 24 de junio han rescatado casi 8.900 personas que trataban de cruzar el mar Mediterráneo.
La comunidad internacional debe mejorar sus políticas públicas en los temas de migración y encontrar nuevas maneras de mejorar las vidas y las condiciones de trabajo de los migrantes, declaró el director general de la Organización Internacional del Trabajo, OIM, este miércoles. Guy Ryder fue uno de los encargados de abrir el Foro Mundial sobre Migración y Desarrollo en Alemania, que durante 3 días reúne a más de 700 representantes del sector público y privado, así como de organizaciones internacionales y la sociedad civil de más de 140 países. El objetivo del evento este año es lograr un compromiso social global para la migración y el desarrollo, así como para el equilibrio de los intereses de los migrantes y sus países de acogida. Al respecto, Ryder aseguró que el diálogo para adoptar estos compromisos es una gran oportunidad y recalcó la importancia que estos tienen en la vida de quienes llegan a otro país buscando seguridad, protección y un mejor futuro. Este foro es un vehículo importante que nos puede ayudar a mejorar nuestras respuestas a la migración. Los diálogos y su relación con el sistema de Naciones Unidas nos ayudarán a maximizar la contribución de todos los que estamos involucrados con esta causa. Para el jefe de la OIT, las políticas públicas de los estados son vitales para beneficiar a los migrantes y a las naciones que los acogen. El Foro Mundial se extenderá hasta el 30 de junio y producirá un documento que detallará un marco para la gobernanza efectiva de la migración que será adoptado por Naciones Unidas en 2018. Laura Quiñones, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
Y así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
I'm on the line with activist and court stalker Keith McHenry. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, now I'm at the court again.
So today is the 29th of June, 2017, and we're talking around nearing 11. Why are you in court and with who?
Okay, well, originally I came down because we had a meeting with Dr. Leff about some really crazy stuff. He's the head of the health. Environmental Health Department, and then we went down to the Window 101 to get filed to make sure we could show video of the alleged crime that Abby Samuels was involved in at the Freedom Sleepers.
What is she accused of?
Obstruction. So what had happened was, the police have been telling us, including Deputy Chief Martinez, that you could. That you could lay down on the sidewalk around City Hall, that was considered lawful. You technically couldn't fall asleep, but they were ignoring the fact that people slept. And so people were doing that, and then the Rangers came in and police came in and so on a couple of weeks ago and were hassling people, and people still had some of their belongings along the pathway, including Abby and I had our, blankets and stuff.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, Keith, because for those who are unfamiliar with this, which maybe nobody listening to this broadcast, but there may be some people out of the area who are hearing it for the first time. At City Hall, it's sort of traditional, at least has been until Freedom Sleepers and other homeless activists began to protest, for people to be able to be at City Hall, hold up signs, express concerns, circulate petitions at any hour of the day or night. Then they began restricting hours. Now they've almost completely banned it except during business hours. But the Freedom Sleepers have essentially set up an operation whereby just once a week, as a sort of almost symbolic protest, they have shown up every Tuesday for the last 2 years in order to raise the issue that in Santa Cruz, a strange city with a homeless population of 1,000 to 2,000 people in the city alone, has shelter for less than 5% of those people, if you want to call it shelter. They require you to have checks and a pathway to housing, or they did. I'm not familiar what Kramer's Homeless Lack of Services Center is doing right now. But in any case, in response, Freedom Sleepers began sleeping illegally on the sidewalk, but making care not to obstruct the sidewalk, because even though it is illegal to sleep after 11, the city, for some reason, perhaps PR reasons, didn't want to enforce that part of the law, at least not at the City Hall itself or on the sidewalks adjacent. But recently, times have gotten tougher, and I think you're telling me that activist Abby Samuels has now gotten ticketed for obstructing the sidewalk, even though she was taking up no more than half of it?
Yeah, she was only taking up half of it. Now, their theory was that if a car pulled up, and a passenger was in the passenger side and wanted to park at exactly the place where her sleeping bag and my sleeping bag were, that they could not get out of the car and step onto the sidewalk.
Now, of course,
that was the theory, and it was right at 8 o'clock this happened. Oddly enough, they just, she then refused to sign the citation, and three cops just took her away, leaving all the belongings there. And videotape evidence shows that she was willing to move the belongings if a car arrived and had no problem with that. The other thing that's pretty clear was no cars were even parked within the entire city block.
Keith, two things come to mind. One of them is that, and I could be wrong about this, but you might have your battery of attorneys check on this one, of which I assume you have none at the moment, but who knows. One is that the state law on obstructing preempts the city code. That's number one. So they got to go for the state law, and then you get a jury trial on that. And the second is that, as you say, obstructing means intentionally and willfully refusing to move and blocking the sidewalk, and she wasn't doing either one. But aside from my little legal tip from my safe little nook up here, you know, safely away from the crime scene, I guess the issue was, did Abby ever get back her property? And, of course, did the same kind of situation reoccur in Freedom Sleepout 103, which happened two nights ago? This issue with Abby happened a couple of weeks ago, didn't it?
Correct, yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And actually, I was there and just collected her the items, which I also owned, and put them in my car. And then when she got released from jail, she went to work. But we didn't lose any property, but it's been very interesting. So last Tuesday, not the one before the most recent Freedom Sleepers, you know, the very heavy ranger and police efforts to drive people away, which failed. And then this past Tuesday, the 103rd sleepout, there was no presence at all of rangers in the afternoon or police. One officer came by in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock and told people that were one sleeping up by the fountain in the front of City Hall and one sleeping person sleeping by the flagpole with quite a lot of belongings that they had to move, and several other people, that they couldn't sleep on the red bricks or in the campus. They had to go to the sidewalk. And then a couple people did move to the sidewalk, but most people just, you know, stayed in place, and officer left and nothing happened. And then two rangers came in the morning and just stood around and chatted and never told anybody to do anything or anything like that.
How many people
Quite
would you
a different experience.
How many people would you estimate slept on 103 two nights ago?
I think we count, I forget, we actually posted it. It was like something in the area of like 23 people or something like that, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very quiet and, you know, really good evening. And Travis injured himself, you know, had a seizure during breakfast. So there was a large, you know, the fire department and ambulance came and he got to go get stitches. And so there was that issue, but no police stuff going on. Another person, Charles, who is new to here, he ended up getting he lost his shoes and socks in that night and woke up with only one shoe. He was actually in the, in an area that traditionally the police would have told him it was illegal to be there, but they never talked to him. And he was loud, and there was a threat of bringing police to hassle him, but when we brought video cameras to videotape that, it just didn't happen. And the officers seemed to run from the video cameras, kind of interesting. We've been posting a lot of video. We have one funny video. This is on the Santa Cruz Who Not Bombs YouTube channel. And one of the videos is of an officer, the one that cited me for In Park After Hours when I was videotaping them, ticket Gregory, who died later that afternoon, back on April 19th, 2017. She lost the case because she didn't really understand the sign system and what was going on. And I was able to show that the signs she was claiming were there were not there. But
let me interrupt you
anyway,
for a moment. Keith, let me interrupt
came
you.
Came and tried to get rid of us off the sitting on the stone wall around City Hall.
But before you go into that, two things. The issue, and this is the broader issue that I've always been pressing, or at least in the last 3 or 4 months when I've been around, the survival sleepers that are no longer permitted, not just at City Hall, on the bricks, not just at night, but during the day, not just on the City Hall grounds, but on the sidewalk, not just on the sidewalk, but on the adjacent streets and in the library. And you were telling me in the past they've moved to the post office area, but then I heard contradictory testimony that very few people were staying there during the day. What's been the situation for the last week with the survival sleepers?
Okay, they're not there in huge numbers in the day, but there are a lot of people, probably 25 to 30, maybe more people sleeping around the post office up and down Water Street, sometimes at town clock, although the three people that were sleeping there have been there recently. Bank of the West has a community of people living in the under the awning there. There's people sleeping up and down that end of both Front and Pacific, and the community people in the alley by the tea room. So that's where people are living, and that were the people living over. Some people are actually in the hospital. So there's like two people are in the hospital now. So they're been removed from the scene. Three people, actually. But there's new people that have emerged. We had a very sad case of a woman who was friends with one of our regular people. He's actually a person that is, I don't know if he lives on the street or a vehicle. I think he lives in a vehicle. But he was lifelong friends or long-term friends with a woman who was born and raised here in Santa Cruz. And she was had been felt like unsafe by some people came and sexually assaulted her while sleeping outside somewhere downtown. She was newly homeless and really like you could he had me talk to her because he was to see if there was a place she could go. And I suggested that maybe she could go to did she try the shelter homeless lack of services, and she said, well, I do have a Section 8 voucher, but they told me it was thousands of people on the list and didn't even give her an exact number. No one seems to really even know. And that was not possible. And because she was so terrified being victimized as a woman that, I said, after, did she go to Walnut Street, the women's center there? They could not help. Sadly, one of the freedom sleepers, survival sleepers that we know and trust, we suggested that she join another older woman in sleeping in the doorway on Front Street with him. I mean, that's like demented. And, if that was the only suggestion we could have, because it's just run out of time, So Janet Fardette, and Jerome Fardette, the couple that are trying to get rid of the homeless out of town and live across the street in a condominium across the street from downtown post office, have met with environmental health, and they are very upset that all these homeless people have moved in across the street, and they're trying all kinds of new tactics to see if they can get rid of food not bombs. And they made up a story that we were cooking at MH Can, which is a lie, and that's caused a bunch of concern for MH Can because we've never cooked there. And
MH Can, of course, is a mental health clients action network. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's really frightening. So that's why we're down here, actually, originally. But then we ran into our friend Kyle, and he's got a couple of little cases. Hi, how's it going? And so we're supporting him here.
Well, that brings us back to the court situation that we originally found you in. Who's being charged with what today, and where are things?
Oh, well, of all the cases, I don't know. Tom, what's your case? Yeah, it's not clear what's going on with this case. And so you were attacked. Yeah, but being the person without shelter, you were the one arrested? Yeah, and so there's video to show.
Right.
Yeah, and there's video that will show Kyle's side of the story, but they don't have the video. It is kind of a classic thing. We're hearing this quite a bit.
What are you hearing? What are you hearing quite a bit?
People being, there was a bunch of people attacked out at Lighthouse about a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago, sleeping out there. And then, of course, the police only ticketed and bothered the people that were the victims. And this seems to be slightly a pattern here. Mm. We hear this a fair bit.
A lot of people are not clear who steals people's shoes, but people take shoes all the time. And there's some belief that it's housed people, people that are trying to freak out the people living on the streets. So that's really like the total hatred and victimization of people on the streets is really outrageous.
So what's happening?
Lack of protection.
But you will, of course, be protected by the courts, right?
Oh yeah, right. And we're working on there's a forum on Know Your Rights that's happening at Loudoun Nelson on July 18th with Berkeley Cop Watch. Seems like the video camera system is really helping in a lot of cases, like we saw with Charles Wednesday morning. The police just like vanished when we showed up with video cameras. And the story I was telling before was interesting, and I think it's had some impact in that, for instance, when the Rangers came at zero tolerance, is what they were saying, that there'll be zero tolerance at City Hall. That meant you can't have belongings there. Like they were trying to explain, I couldn't have the Food Not Bombs literature table, the signs, food, the nothing like that could be there. And then they were, saying you couldn't sit on the stone wall that people have been sitting on since the Great Depression. And so they come up to, I explained to the ranger that I also had zero tolerance for fascism, so I could totally see his point. And he had zero tolerance for disobeying these signs, which are completely, I suspect, unenforceable, because there's probably nothing really about them that can be...
You talked about this last week. Has there been any ticketing for... I don't know, misuse of public property, supposedly for sitting on the wall or something like that?
No, after the Wednesday videotaping of the cop, it seems like no ticketing. They do tell people it's illegal to be there, but it's kind of on again, off again. It's the people, the thing that seems to be happening now is people are being told they have warrants and that they, and that's the way to scare people off of the City Hall area. But we had like a ton of people there Wednesday, and it just kind of lingered and lingered. And the week before, the same thing. We spent the whole day out there.
And Thursday this morning, was there you probably wouldn't know, but there was this coffee clatch at the library outside where...
I don't know, in that I was over here at an 8 o'clock meeting.
And Food Not Bombs is not only preparing food for Freedom Sleepers and the Saturday and Sunday meals, but are you also providing food for the court actions?
Not of most court actions, but some. And we are preparing, we have done sanctuary, emergency alert events. We've been providing the meals for that. And we've been doing, we do have the second anniversary of the Freedom Sleepers weekly sleep out will be on July 4th. And we'll be doing food at that, of course. And we're trying to get some of the street musicians to perform. I've got one so far that's said he would. And so that will be the second anniversary of being out there every week for 2 years.
But you've been...
we're doing that. And then Abby's case is the next day at 1:30 at Department 10 in... at the courthouse on Ocean Street.
Now, Abby's case is a misdemeanor or an infraction?
It's an infraction. And then I have an October case on the a writ on the appeal process for the orders to vacate. I've got that in October.
This is the...
I just have a little arraignment on a... the case that resulted in the other case. What is that one? I don't even know what it is. I should not say it. I should find it.
You're talking about the Parks and Rec pseudo stay away order nonsense.
Yeah. Here it is. Here's my cases. So I have a arraignment on the Thursday the 6th of July at 8:30, Department 10. on the 5th of October, 8:30 department. I can't possibly, I don't know what department that is. Oh, they don't know the department yet. So, anyway, that's what I got going down now.
Well, don't let them grind you down. All these, of course, attempts to move you here, there, and everywhere. How's support for Food Not Bombs growing?
Oh, it is really growing. It's insane. And we have to go in now to court. But it's incredible. That, I mean, I can't believe the support. We have people come up in tears thanking us for what we're doing yesterday. It's insane.
Mm.
So I should go in to courtroom 2, and I will sign off.
All right.
Up on .net.
Thank you,
okay.
Steve.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hop to Hippity Hop with Uncle Robert here at Bathrop Spears Broadside. 2 hours of in-your-face chatter. You can get in on it at 427-3772 this May 3rd, 2001. Why don't you?
It's March 30th. We're near Lulu Carpenter's on a very sunny day on Pacific Avenue, about 10 to 2, talking to a pair of individuals who are dressed for the sunshine. Your name, sir?
Stan.
Stan, you are you're leaving town, but you have a concern about a number of open container tickets.
Yeah, I went to court and I resolved. I had 7 open container tickets, so I was given a choice of a week in jail or 168 hours of community slavery.
And your choice was?
Well, I signed up for the community slavery, which I have until October to complete it, which time I plan to come back and just turn myself in and go to jail.
In fact, these are infractions, right?
Correct.
You weren't. These were, yeah, and it should be the case if you are poor that there's a defense that says you don't have to do either community service or pay for infractions or do jail time, that they have to sue you civilly if you're indigent. That's their.
True?
Well, that is the defense that's been used successfully in some cases, unsuccessfully in others. Now, were you, in fact, wandering around drunk, attacking women and
no,
men?
No. I was merely sitting down and consuming a can of beer.
Where did this serious crime happen?
Various places around town, down by the river, alleyways, and parking lots, whatever.
Now, you are what? Are you under 21?
No, sir. 47.
You have a probation condition that forbids your using alcohol?
No. No.
Are you a violent individual when you drink alcohol, since we know it is, in fact, a dangerous drug?
No.
Well, hey, all I can say is...
Well, I believe the law should be more lenient. I think that the container of alcohol should be legal to be consumed in public. If a person becomes disorderly, well, that'd be a different situation.
Well, it is legal if you're doing it in front of Lulu Carpenter's Cafe, which has a liquor license.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Of course, a little more expensive than buying a beer yourself.
Yeah, but, you know, for a person in my economic straits, I don't think I can...
Well, perhaps you should move to Modesto.
Or maybe I should buy my own island 50 miles offshore.
Or perhaps you could try swimming to Japan, which is the latest solution for the homeless community.
Well, you know, I've heard they're going to dig a big ditch between Mexico and the United States and bury all the homeless there. You know?
Well, that certainly...
Maybe nuclear waste, too.
Certainly is an extremist suggestion. I cannot entertain that, but we'll talk to you about that later in private. Thank you very much.
I've heard rumors.
So we're at the Cafe Royale at about 2:05, and I'm talking to a person who's trying to finish a chocolate macaroon and is being, of course, interrupted by my tirades, for which we'll talk to the Green Party about this later. And this is actually, this is a woman named Chris, who we spoke with, I think I interviewed you a couple years ago.
No, you never have.
I never interviewed. Maybe I just spoke with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've spoken a few times.
And you're a person who's both been homeless and also been a member of the bar.
Yes.
We're not talking about the ASTI either.
No, although I've been a member of that bar too.
You've been a member of a number of different bars. There's no bar to the membership you've been a member of.
That's true. So,
how long have you been in Santa Cruz, Chris?
About 20 years.
And were you born here?
No, I wasn't, but I came here at a pretty early age.
And what kind of have you actually done work as an attorney locally, or
yes.
What kind of work were you doing?
For a few years, I had a general civil practice here in town, and then I did, ironically enough, I was doing housing law, poverty housing law.
Are you still up in that field?
No.
But it wouldn't take you, if you got some kind of funding and decided to pick up that career again, perhaps you might not like the career, but would you think you'd have sufficient expertise to be able to give people a sense as to where to start in that area?
Definitely. Yeah, and all I have to, my license is still current, it's inactive right now, so all I'd have to do is pay the bar a couple $100 in order to practice again.
You've also been homeless in Santa Cruz. Are you currently homeless?
Yes.
And where do you, are you in a car, are you outside, are you squatting?
I'm staying with some people now until I get back on my feet, which is a huge step up for me.
You were on the streets before?
I was on the streets for almost a year, and then I was accepted into Page Smith, and I relapsed in my recovery program and got booted out of there 2 months ago.
We're talking heroin, drugs, or alcohol?
Drugs and alcohol.
And any comments on that for folks who are new to the subject or may have some stereotypes or misconceptions? Is it... would you say that has being homeless produced drug problems or drug abuse problems for you or alcohol abuse problems? I'm not sure what they are, whatever they are. Or is that a function of, did that happen before when you were in a house? Or tell me to mind my own business?
No, it's a complicated question, and it's a very good question. I think my very first, it's the most simple observation is that it's extremely difficult to stay clean and sober on the streets. And I would say that's true whether you have the disease of alcoholism or drug addiction, which I do, or not. The disease, the second thing is that the disease clearly cuts through class lines. And that's very obvious by, you know, just going down to the lot or running the street, meeting some of the people. And the third thing, I think, is that oppression by drug addiction and alcoholism keeps us down, keeps us homeless.
Say that one more time.
I think the oppression caused by drug addiction and alcoholism and the misperceptions of it as a moral deficiency as opposed to a disease, which it is, help keep us down and homeless.
And in fact, there are those who believe that homelessness is some kind of moral deficiency, with the exception of, let's say, that small group of worthy homeless. Everybody else is either a drug addict or a drunk or a crazy or a bum or a rainbow person.
Although I'm joking a little bit, although...
But less of a human being because of that.
Yes.
That's what they're saying. If these aren't real human beings that deserve civil rights or assistance or consideration.
Exactly. And there is that class to be reckoned with that I have discovered on the streets, which are people who are homeless by choice. And
many of those folks?
I'm sorry?
Are there many of those folks?
I found there to be a fairly large percentage down on the streets of people who prefer that lifestyle. I don't. It breaks my back. But there are a lot of people who, and I think that's an interesting, it was an interesting thing for me to learn simply because it has to add another element of respect in a weird sort of way. It's like if people choose to live that way, all the more reason, you know, they are entitled to civil rights because of that lifestyle, because of a choice.
Have you had civil rights problems yourself? When was the last time you were actually homeless in the most extreme on the street sense of it? I mean, you're homeless now because you don't have a home and you're relying on some temporary assistance, which means like somebody's couch or somebody's, you know,
spare room.
A hayloft, a place in the manger,
right.
Whatever you will.
Spare room. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have a spare room right now. But I was actually, I was living, I crawled out from under a folding table in the Holy Cross Church storage yard last November to check myself into Janus. And I literally crawled. I was that sick.
And how did it go in Janus? It's the only drug program in town, right? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, there's the camp, but it's private. And if you don't have private insurance, you're out of luck. There are other programs. Janus is the only other residential program. There's a couple in Watsonville for women, but they have to be women with children. I mean, there are stricter guidelines. Janus is a wonderful place.
How many people does it usually take care of at any one time?
There's usually around 10 clients in detox and around 20 in residential.
And how did it do for you?
Oh, great. I've got so much support from there. I mean, I'm still getting continuing support. So even though, you know, I've had a couple relapse problems, they've been totally behind me, 100%, and they will help anybody who wants help.
Any civil rights violations you've found, either against yourself personally, that you've witnessed or that you know about and are fairly sure happened in the last few months regarding the Santa Cruz police or deputy sheriffs or private security guards or whatever for homeless people?
Well, of course, you see on the streets, you see how people become suspects simply because of their homeless status. That happens all the time. There's a heightened level of expectation by the cops that somebody's going to have been a criminal or they're about to be or they're doing some kind of criminal activity or they're loaded or possessing or any sort of thing. There's an assumption, which is not granted by law. Of course, it's only granted if somebody's on parole or probation with no search and seizure clause. But short of that, I see it all the time, all the time.
How about such things as sleeping and sitting, which this town is now criminalized, at least in some circumstances? It's illegal to sleep anywhere on public property after 11 o'clock at night on pain of a $54 fine. And it's most private property, or much private property, is also, there's the so-called camping ban, which also is a sleeping ban, and it has sleeping ban sections. Have you heard of any tickets being issued or hassles going on?
I'm not aware of that, and I haven't been down at the lot to talk to folks. And by the lot, I'm referring to the Homeless Resource Center area. I haven't actually been down there to talk to folks in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
It's been around for 20 years, this law. It didn't affect you?
I thought you were referring to something new.
No, it's the same old law.
Okay. Yeah, camping tickets. I have friends, lots and lots and lots of friends that have stacked camping tickets.
Recently or in old book?
Yes, recently. Uh-huh. And I, as recently as November, have been hassled myself just trying to get some sleep. I had to get away from an abusive relationship where I was living in a van with my cat and this man. And in order to get away from him, she and I had to flee. We had nowhere to go, so that's where we ended up at Holy Cross. And they were wonderful. They let me stay up under that folding table for 3 weeks until I got into Janus. They just pretended like I wasn't there. But I was obviously a woman, you know, in need of help. And that's a whole other class in itself, you know, because we're of course a little more sympathetic. If I'd been a white male with long hair, such as yourself,
a blue-eyed blonde like yourself,
who knows, right?
Shocking, I might add. Some of us are trauma. Even if we would to be granted that basic, still mean it would be illegal to put a tent up to cover yourself in the rain. It would still be illegal to light a fire if it's cold, even in a fire pit, which is allowed for that purpose. It would still be illegal to sleep in a park after dark under existing laws in Santa Cruz. That's still the situation here. So some folks have been getting together to try to challenge this. As always, some of us are always on the issue. I'm one of them. But there's a sort of a more mainstream group called the Monday Morning Group, which had formed around the sleeping ban, but now has kind of become more diluted to general issues of homelessness and in trying to get together with the mayor and other council members has excluded people like myself, or specifically me, from their group in order to please the city council so they can have some kind of, you know, negotiating process. I've always said that's not wise unless you should really stick to your guns, determine the composition of your own group, and as long as people aren't being disruptive. But there are different kinds of strategies being used by different groups. The Green Party supposedly is considering its Green Party mayor, Tim Fitzmaurice, seems to be in conflict because he supports the sleeping ban or continues to do nothing to change it,
right,
while the platform of the Green Party says no sleeping bans.
Right.
So there's a problem there, and Green Party, for my raising the issue strongly, is after my ass, I'll tell you. So, putting
yours,
well,
after his.
Yes, I would. I mean, that's why I keep asking. I'm saying, you know, if you're going to go after me, why not just spend a little time going after him? You know, I mean, he's the one who's doing this. But the answer, of course, is he's the Green Party mayor.
He's
a
politician.
He's a politician. He's a Green Party member and longstanding. You know, we don't want to go after him, at least not without a long and elaborate process. So, my talking about this, my mentioning this on this tape, will produce still more determination by some Green Party members that I am a renegade, that I am somehow ungreen, and so forth. But that's how it goes. Homeless people have some options in court. The recent court decisions in the last couple of years, the Tobe case, followed by the Eichhorn case, ruled that it is a requirement of a camping ticket that a homeless person be allowed a chance to mount a necessity defense. And I know you're familiar with the necessity, probably familiar as an attorney. You admit the crime, but you say there was a greater necessity for doing it. And you have to prove six different points. Now, in the past, judges have said, well, we will sometimes and we won't. But the Eichhorn decision was a ruling that they had to do so. They had to allow it, because otherwise people who are outside and have survival needs were simply, they had to be able to show that this was not a violation, that they were not guilty because they had a necessity to survive under camping tickets, and there were no other options open to them. So what I'm wondering is, if we can recruit you as a legal helper in some way, and I'll turn off the tape recorder for your answer. So what is your answer?
Yes, I'm definitely willing to help, but I've indicated that to Karen Brock. We're both kind of waiting till I was more on my feet health-wise to jump in, but I'm not working, and it seems like a good time to be doing something. Especially now that, for me, it's good to have a little distance from the streets. I mean, it's helped some. It's helped my perspectives on things.
Definitely. So, Chris, do you want to give your full name on the air?
Sure. It's Chris Fredrickson.
And for folks who want to reach Chris Fredrickson, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, which is my Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line. And I can pass on a message if you have a camping ticket. She may or may not be able to help because she has her own survival needs. But hopefully we'll be able to get some kind of maybe a flyer out on a general reasonable doubt defense, how you would approach the issue, the law itself and how you can challenge it, how to file an appeal in simple language for the lay person. So give a call to 423-HUFF. Chris, is there anything you want to talk about on other concerns that you've noticed as a person who's had legal training on the streets or just generally?
There is one thing I'd like to note. It's a puzzlement to me, which is that I have now become aware of the fact that I now have a second community. Whether I'm ever homeless again or not, I have a new community within my community. Sometimes that homeless, I don't know, this is not really very politically correct to say, but sometimes that homeless community irritates me. And we irritate me because sometimes I feel that we are a bit irresponsible in terms of expectations. And I've learned through the years, like a lot of old politicos have, that you have to work some within the system. You have to, in order to get anything done. Although Santa Cruz is certainly, you know, an ideal place to do that. What I would like to hear about are ideas from people in terms of compromises on the camping ban, compromises as to where people might be able to sleep, where they can, you know, where we can lay our heads and not expect to be killed for it. Because I'm at a bit of an odds with this thing. It's the horns of the dilemma. I see that we are irresponsible sometimes in our expectations and our demands, and yet I know that those expectations and demands are real and legitimate because I am now a member of the street community. I will always be. I mean, that's how it is.
You're here because you're here.
Yeah. So I'm just curious about that. I don't know what things have, what compromise issues have been brought up, if any, if there should not be any compromise, and if so, how that's going to serve us as people who do live on the streets. If it has to be an all or nothing thing, or I'm searching for ideas on this myself.
This is a pre-recorded tape, but if you have any thoughts you want to pass on to Chris, again, give a call to 423-HUFF or Karen Brock at the Homeless Services Center, who is also concerned about sleeping and camping ban tickets. I believe the phone number there is 458-6020. I think it's extension 12, but you can certainly find out by calling. It is extension 12. And they're only open during the weekdays during business hours, but HUFF is a 24-hour line. So give us a call if you've got anything to report or concerns or questions to raise. Anything you want to add, Chris?
I can't think of anything else. Not now, anyway. It probably won't since you shut the tape off.
No doubt. You've got some. You came back to town as a woman who'd been a career attorney here, and you met an old friend who was an attorney, and this guy said, "Why didn't you just come on in?" And your reaction to that was,
I was shocked actually, because I assumed that he would understand my feelings of shame, and my feelings of guilt, and my feelings of once you enter the homeless community, you become in essence a ghost in your own hometown. That's the way I felt the whole time I was out on the streets. I felt like a lot of it had to do with my drug addiction and alcoholism as well, but the combination is a total killer. I mean, you become a non-entity, you know, walking around town, dodging people, dodging eye contact. And for him to even though he works, he helps out a lot, he does a lot of pro bono work with the homeless community, I was surprised at his reaction. That why didn't I simply call and say, gosh, I've become homeless. It was an eye opener for both of us, you know, definitely.
In the last street shit sheet, number 164, we talked about David Silva and a companion who were pulled over and harassed by a deputy, Mark Yanez. And Silva had some really horrific stories to tell about Yanez, claiming that one of the officers, and one of them was Yanez, may have planted either a needle or drugs, that he was actually, we're talking about medications that were legal that he had on him, and instead he was taken to jail. He and his companion were charged a bail. He was finally, after going to the Board of Supervisors and the sheriff and really raising holy hell, they were able to get the charges on his companion dropped, though David Silva still has a court date. Yanez apparently had been harassing Silva and his companion in previous incidents when they were filing a complaint about his behavior, and this, according to Silva, was retaliation for that complaint. I actually gave a copy of the street shit sheet to Deputy Yanez via another deputy, and I haven't heard back from him, so he knows that there is some concern about his behavior, and of course he has a right to reply and to respond. I got a letter a couple of days ago from the jail after a phone call from the same individual on a previous Free Radio Santa Cruz edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the name of the show that I do twice a week. He called into this station, Collect, and spoke about, again, Deputy Yanez, and he talked about it quite articulately, but he also wrote this letter, which I'm going to read, and after that I'm going to call up a corroborating witness to talk about the deputy's behavior, and I guess by reflection, the system of how the police and the sheriffs operate in Santa Cruz. And here's his letter. To whom this may concern, Free Radio, re-civil rights violations, re-police harassment. Hello, my name is Stephen S. Walton. I believe I have that right. Let's double check. Yeah, I think it is Walton. That's a little L there. At this time, I'm housed in the Santa Cruz County Jail. Friday the 13th of April, my girlfriend's car broke down after dropping off her coworker on Lee Brandt Street, Beach Hill. My girlfriend came home and told me she forgot her California ID and some money in the glove box. Would I walk to the car and retrieve this stuff? She was very tired from work, so I walked from our home on Delaware Avenue down to the vehicle on Lee Brandt and Holden Street. I reached our vehicle. I opened the vehicle door. The keys are in my lap. As I retrieve the California ID from the glove box, along with $40 and a mint certs, I put the mint certs in my mouth when this officer Yanez approaches me and tells me he's with the sheriff's department. My response was, "Yeah, so?" Officer Yanez said to me, "What did you put in your mouth?" I said, "A certs," and I then showed him the certs package. Officer Yanez then flies into a rage, yelling at me, "Are you on parole or probation?" I said, "Parole." Officer Yanez then says, "I'm in the wrong neighborhood. Am I under arrest for driving on a suspended license." I ask, "How's that?" when I walk to this car and the keys are not in the ignition. Officer Yanez's response is, "No one will believe you. I'm transported to county jail." At the county jail, Officer Yanez proceeds to tell me I have no rights because I'm on parole. Officer Yanez then starts shouting at me because I'm not able to urinate into a bottle for a drug test on his command. He's yelling, I'm going to go back to prison where I belong. At that point, I told Mr. Yanez, we're done, as I was booked. The following Monday, my girlfriend, Lonnie, was phoned by Officer Yanez, and she was told she could come down to the sheriff's office to retrieve her California ID. She was approached by Officer Yanez, who then told her in order to retrieve her California ID, she had to pass a drug test or be subjected to arrest. She was then taken to a dark room by Officer Yanez. Her rights were not read, nor was she allowed a phone call. She was physically searched by Officer Yanez, that's Mark Yanez, by the way, he's a man, without a female officer present. She told me she was terrified of being thrown in jail with no reason. She stated to me she felt as if this officer was going to rape her with the way he was looking at her and acting towards her. Officer Yanez kept telling her she's too skinny to not be on heroin. This Officer Yanez then let her go home only after being terrified and violated. I, at this time, have now been in jail 2 weeks awaiting test results for this urinalysis. I've been charged with driving on a suspended license in a car that was not running, which was towed that afternoon. I'm charged of being under the influence, and yet no urine sample as of now has been produced to prove this. Plus, there's now a parole violation and loss of employment. To Officer Yanez's comment, I have no rights. I only gave up three rights, the right to bear firearms, the right to vote, and the right to evade search and seizure protections. Where was this officer's probable cause to even stop me? I have the right to be protected from harassment and profiling by corrupt officers. I hope that our community and society takes a better stand against people like Officer Yanez. Who are abusive to the badge and looks like an abuse to my tax dollars. I don't know what to do as far as making a civil complaint. Please write back. Please feel free to contact my fiance, girlfriend. And he then gives his name, Stephen S. Walton. And his prisoner number is 185281 at 259 Water Street at the county jail. And he says, please feel free to share this written statement with listeners and petitioners. And that was a letter I received about 3 days ago. And what I'm going to do now is get a hold of Lonnie Burton, and ask, this is the woman he's referring to, what her perspective is on this whole situation. Hi there. Are we talking to Lonnie Burton?
Yes, this is her.
Hey, Lonnie. Did you hear the letter from Steve?
Yeah, I did.
And do you have any comments?
Well, basically everything he wrote down is exactly true.
Well, in your own words, how would you describe what happened to you?
Well, he called me, the officer Yanez called me on Monday and said, would I want my ID back? And I said, well, yeah, obviously I would. And he said, well, you need to come down to the sheriff's station and pick it up. And I said, okay. And then he proceeded to ask me, well, do you know why I have it? And I said, yeah, you arrested my boyfriend on Friday. And he said, oh, that's your boyfriend? And I said, yeah. And so I went down there. And when I got down there, he sat down next to me holding my ID, and he said, do you have a minute? I need to ask you some questions. And I said, well, I thought I was just getting my ID, and then you were going to let me go. And he said, I need to look at your arms. And he started inspecting my arms and saying, you're on something.
Now, are you on parole or probation?
No, I'm not on either.
Yeah, he has no right to do that if you choose to tell him to take a hike.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so then he kept saying, you don't look like the same person in your ID. You look much different. And I tried to tell him that was 5 years ago. Nobody looks like the same person in their ID. He said, well, I need to get a better look at you, so please step into this other room. In the other room, like, the lights were a lot dimmer. It was a lot darker, and another male officer came in.
So maybe what he wanted to do was kind of use a braille approach, sort of feel you all over from top to bottom.
Yeah, I don't know. It was really uncomfortable. He brought in this other male officer, and they started shining flashlights in my eyes and made me do all these stupid tests, like counting to 30 seconds in my head, and he's like totally just telling me, I know you're on something, you have to be on something, you're detoxing from heroin, aren't you? What are you on? I know you're on something. And I was like, look, I'm not on anything. And then he said, will you give me a bottle? And I said, well, yeah, definitely, of course. And then he said, all right, you seem like a nice person, so I'm going to let you go.
It sounds like a power trip par excellence.
Yeah.
You know, how long did the whole process take?
About 15 to 20 minutes.
And what day was this?
This was Monday.
Must have been the 16th or something?
Yeah, Monday the 16th.
And do you remember the name of the other officer?
I didn't even get his name. They didn't even tell me.
And about what time of day was this?
Ooh, I would say it would probably be around 1 or 2 in the afternoon.
You know, this is the kind of thing that, I mean, you certainly should file a complaint, but that'll go nowhere, but still be useful to do it. But what you really want to do is get together with some other people who have been abused by different, by the sheriffs or by other police departments, and just have a press conference.
Yeah.
And talk about this, and talk about the need to have a real shake-up of the police department and some real independent review and some real, you know, old-fashioned prosecutions of bad cops.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Now, you're a working person, right?
Yeah.
Do you mind saying where you work?
I work at Noah's Bagels, downtown Santa Cruz.
And how long have you been working there?
I've been working here for almost a year.
So, you know, you may be a, you know, an onion bagel junkie, but you're probably not a heroin junkie. At least it's not interfering with your work.
No.
And the sharp-eyed Mark Yanez can't seem to find any tracks on your arms, although, of course, he didn't investigate all your orifices. So.
Right.
What has this ever happened to you or any of your friends before?
I haven't heard of it happening to anyone before. Anyone I've told is like, are you kidding me? How could they do that? That's not right. You know, one of my family members is a lawyer, and he said, you know, that was really uncalled for. He should have at least let you contact your lawyer. You know, he shouldn't have been questioning you like that. You went down there thinking you were just going to pick up your ID, and they baited you into a situation that you didn't need to be in.
Well, I think that you should broadcast this story more widely, although, of course, there's always the danger that you'll face some kind of retaliation. You're aware of that, of course.
Yeah, right.
And it's a risk I take, but it's certainly a risk that, you know, you take too,
mm-hmm.
and that Steve takes. How's he doing in jail?
He's doing okay. I mean, for someone who doesn't really need to be in there.
Now, so he is, it's been, what, 2-3 weeks, and he still is sitting in jail waiting for a urinalysis test to prove he was intoxicated while walking?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, people say, well, he's on parole, you know, he gives up some rights. And I say, he doesn't give up the right to be walking in a neighborhood. He doesn't give up the right to go to my car because I've been at work for 9 hours and I'm exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't give up those sort of rights. He's still a human being.
Well, you know, I think, Lonnie, it would be good to put you in on television if you're up for that. You know, and to do a little segment, there's a community television show which I may be able to introduce the producer in putting you on.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, maybe even Steve, too, if he gets out in time, and he should be getting out.
He should, yeah.
And also I'd like to hook you up with David Silva, who suffered a similar abusive practice from David Silva. And I think of all the victims of this deputy, if in fact your stories are accurate and you're telling the truth, that, you know, then you guys need to come together and just demand some remedial action. I mean, you know, it's always a sort of, you know, a truism that the one bad cop, you know, spoils it for the other cops.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, I think that the system tends to produce bad cops. So I don't have a lot of, you know, sympathy for, you know, the general. I think the institutions make it easier to be corrupt, and they protect the corrupt cops.
Well, I was grown up to trust cops, and I was grown up to, you know, those are the people you go to when you're in trouble. And now
right.
I'm feeling like those are the ones I'm supposed to run from because they're causing the trouble, you know?
Right, although this is the only incident you know that this
right.
has been a problem. And so that's, we do want to, you know, I've found numerous problems in the community, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't want to put upon you my interpretation.
Right.
The other thing is I'm going to suggest that a newspaper reporter get in touch with you and see if he or she can do something to get this story out because,
okay.
you know, while we do get we have an audience of several million here at Free Radio, nonetheless, we should have more than the 7 people that listen to the show hear, you know, what's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anything else? Your relatives were somewhat shocked to hear this?
Yeah, they were all pretty much appalled at the fact that this officer would try to bait me into a situation of trying to give a drug test and trying to inspect my arms and pulling me into another room where it's dimly lit. And, you know, my mom was the most upset. She was outraged. She even called Mr. Yanez but never got through to him.
Interesting. Are you guys an old-time Santa Cruz family? Or?
No, I just moved here.
Where from?
Last May, from Mountain View.
Uh-huh. What does your mom do?
She's a teacher.
Is she still in Mountain View? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I think this is worth pursuing, and I appreciate you having the courage and, I don't know. I mean, I think it's good judgment, too, to go public with this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's more likely that you'll get some kind of response one way or the other.
Yeah, I think so.
And I'll get back to you during the next few minutes and give you a couple numbers to call for contacts with other media, because I think you need to get in touch with that. Plus, contact with activist David Silva.
Okay.
Hey, we're talking to Lonnie Say it again?
Burton.
Thank you. Lonnie Burton here, who has had a, well, her boyfriend is apparently suffering incarceration from the actions of Deputy Yanez. And you yourself, well, it sounds like you were falsely arrested. I mean, you were held in a situation in the police department, the sheriff's department, that you did not essentially, you weren't there for, there was no charge against you. It was an abusive, I would call it a false imprisonment, frankly. That's just my, you know, lawyer speak. I'm not a lawyer, but that's what I'd say.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you for calling, and I will get back to you, Lonnie, and thank you. And if you hear of any other instances of concerns around police misconduct, or if you have some good stuff, you know, let us know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And that goes for you out there, too, all you Free Radio Santa Cruisers, all you folks just listening in who haven't, perhaps are spinning the radio dial and come up with this strange station which has interviews with actual people in the community and not just some canned vanilla whoop-de-doop from the National Public Radio or endless commercials or right-wing talk show hosts. It's a station worth supporting, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and if you're interested in learning more about us, give a call to 427-4523. You can catch us. We stream on the net, www.microradio.net/frsc. And, hey, it's your station and it's your community, and hopefully the more you use it, the better the community gets, at least the more we know what's going on in the community. 96.3 FM is our station, and we continue. This time we're going to be doing a little listening to, this is an interesting thing. A close friend of mine was subjected to a demand that her son be fingerprinted or else she could not continue to receive food stamps. And we took this to a hearing and recorded the hearing. You're going to hear part of that hearing now.
The county, the issue as I understand it is the discontinuance of the food stamps because all adult food stamp household members did not meet the
This is the prosecutor presenting the case for discontinuing the food stamps.
Beginning in September, we advised the claimant that we needed to schedule the fingerprint and photo imaging. The claimant met the photo imaging and fingerprint imaging requirements herself in October. Her son did not appear, had not appeared, and it was the county's understanding in, I believe, beginning in November that Alex was refusing to be imaged, photo and fingerprint imaged. In mid-December 1219, a boot camp discontinuance notice was mailed, discontinuing benefits effective 1231 because all household members had not cooperated with the ESPIS requirement. The county would hold that our discontinuance is correct because Alex is required to be finger and photo imaged and he has not cooperated with that requirement.
I will turn it over. I don't have any questions.
Okay. I have a number of points I'd like to make here.
This is the woman who is
first off, I believe that deficiencies in the SFIS data collection process exist. At the time I was fingerprinted, I was given no brochure or information sheet explaining both the need for the procedure or how the data would be used. I asked for an advocate to be present during the procedure. My request was denied. I was told I could not have an advocate present for my own protection. The worker conducting the fingerprint collection was not wearing a name tag or any other identification. No certificate was visible showing the worker to be authorized or trained to collect the data. At the time I was imaged, six other applicants were also being imaged. All of us were women. A few of us had infants or small children in tow. Discussion among the applicants revealed that all the women resented the procedure, felt intimidated by the process, and submitted only because non-compliance
would result in lack of financial support for the women and their children. That they were being treated like criminals. Since the treatment of the women is so humiliating, many eligible applicants may be deterred from collecting aid entirely, which would harm both the applicant and their minor children. My next point is that the imaging and photo IDing is unfairly applied. Federal funds to assist needy persons are issued to Cash Assistance Program for immigrants, Medi-Cal recipients, refugee cash assistance, Social Security recipients, general assistance or general relief recipients, and Internal Revenue Service refund check recipients. In each of these cases, fraud in the form of multiple claims or under an assumed name can and does occur. Yet none of these recipients are required to be fingerprinted or ID imaged. Only in cases where the vast majority of recipients are women is fingerprinted and photo IDing a requirement. This policy is discriminatory against poor women with children. My next point is that I have no authority to compel compliance from my adult son. My son, Alex Southard, is a legal adult, and he is not subject to parental control. Hence, it is not within the ability or the authority of myself to compel him to comply with the procedure. Yet the rule is such that a claimant and her minor children are penalized for an act not of their making and beyond their control. My son is on the property lease as an equal partner. My only recourse to continue receiving food stamps for my minor children is to evict my adult son from the household. However, I have no authority to do so. My next point is that my son should not be considered part of my food stamp household. My son works full-time in the food industry and receives 80% of his meals at work. As the only vegetarian in the family, he purchases and prepares his food separately. Yet the rules forbid separation as a separate food household until age 22. This policy is capricious and arbitrary, as there is nothing magic about the age of 22. In actuality, my son is a de facto separate food household. My next point is that I have no access to my adult son's wages. Although my son works full time, I do not receive his wages. He contributes to my family's finances by providing for his share of our rental costs and paying for his own food. He is neither obligated nor inclined to use his money to pay for his minor sister and brother's meals. He has expressed a desire to move out of my home and get his own place, but the cost of housing in Santa Cruz has made this option unavailable thus far. He is concentrating on saving his money for a first, last, and security deposit. I have calculated that my son's full-time income, set against the standard set by the Coalition for a Living Wage of Santa Cruz County, comparing this standard, my son only earns 54% of a living wage here in Santa Cruz. He has no additional income to support my minor children or myself. For my son to move out before he has sufficient funding to move into new housing is for him to become homeless. My next point is that SFIS violates the Eighth Amendment. Punitive action requiring me to evict my older son in order to receive food for my minor children is harmful to my family unit, and the punishment goes far beyond the, quote, crime of not submitting to fingerprinting, especially in the absence of either evidence or allegations of actual fraud occurring. Since the state has taken the position that preserving the family unit is a priority, the ruling violates that position while providing no evidence that any harm has been avoided by said action. The ruling amounts to cruel and unusual punishment and that of an excessive fine being imposed. My next point is that lack of food stamps has caused my minor children to suffer. As Alex's wages increased, my food stamp allotment has diminished. This has resulted in having less nutritious food available for my minor children. Growing children need ample fresh fruits and vegetables, good quality bread, milk, eggs for optimal development and growth. The strangulation of my benefits has resulted in my having to serve meals that have been progressively less nutritious. This ruling has already resulted in harm to my children. If benefits are completely cut off, even more harm will result. My next point is that my case should be governed by rules operating when my first case was open. Under the form, and I don't have the number for this form, but the title of the form says New Cash Aid and Food Stamp Rules, Fingerprint Imaging and Photo Imaging. In this paper, it says, applicants must fingerprint or photo image before food stamps can be issued. My children and I have been receiving aid since before the regulation was implemented. Therefore, my household should be subject to the rules required at the onset of my case, not regulations imposed at a later date. Regulations should be applicable to cases opened after enactment of the new policy. My next point is that rules violate my Fourth Amendment rights to privacy. SFIS imposes needlessly on my right to privacy and the right of the people to be secure in their person, house, papers, and effects. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches. These searches of a person are to be conducted only after a warrant has been issued and only when the person has been arrested and suspected of committing a crime. I have not given consent for such a search. The state has not accused myself or my adult son of committing a crime. The state has not proved the necessity of burdening myself with the responsibility of providing intimate and private information without a warrant for the alleged purpose of preventing or prosecuting welfare fraud, which is stated on page 26. The state is not conducting an investigation into any particular crime. Hence, it has no right to perform a search on an applicant's person. In the case of criminal law, an officer may detain a person if they have a reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred, and the subject can be linked to that crime either as a culprit or as a witness. During this detention, an officer may only conduct a pat-down search to determine if the detainee is armed. Only when a detainee has been arrested for a crime is it permissible for an officer to search, to ID check, and to photograph and fingerprint the suspect. SFIS bypasses all reasonable suspicion, does not issue a warrant, and invades the applicant's privacy merely for applying for benefits to which any citizen is eligible to apply. My next point is that SFIS will not produce significant reduction in welfare fraud. The top two categories of welfare fraud are as follows. A, failure to report income. B, having a reportedly absent parent living in the home. SFIS will not prevent or provide evidence to prosecute either of these types of cases of welfare fraud. The only types of cases of welfare fraud this system will prevent is if a recipient is collecting in more than one county. which is a rare occurrence, as so much additional documentation is required, such as rent receipts, utility receipts, bank statements, driver's license or California ID card, birth certificate, social security card, and additional documents as well. Very few cases are attempted under this system. These cases are usually discovered as the result of reports from informants. Therefore, SFIS is unnecessary and not justified. The state has not shown that the previous policy prior to SFIS was inadequate. My next point is that SFIS will deter applicants. Since SFIS cannot be proven to prevent or prosecute welfare fraud, since SFIS implementation is costing California taxpayers an estimated $60 million to implement, an amount that will never be recouped by halting welfare fraud, SFIS is in actuality a program designed to deter qualified applicants from applying for benefits and to create an application process that is so intimidating and humiliating, case reduction will occur. In addition, SFIS has the effect of stigmatizing all clients who cooperate with the procedure. My next point is that the state has not demonstrated that adequate protections for the database exist. The SFIS letter to all counties of February 16, 1999 states, images are confidential to County Welfare Department and all others.
And you've been listening to an interview about, a woman has been challenging the state's cutting off of her food stamps because her adult son is refusing to be fingerprinted, feeling that's an invasion of his privacy and an unnecessary form of intrusion. We're going to hear more of that, but we have, interrupting this, a phone call from the Santa Clara County Jail, which is the jail facility in San Jose, and we're on the line with Jim Costner, an activist who has himself, brought new distinction to the Columbus statue. That is to say, he is, should we say, distributed to the masses in the forms of different pieces of dust and rock fragments. In other words, he smashed the Columbus statue. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Mr. Radio.
Hi there. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing okay, besides being in a cage for tearing down a statue of Christopher Columbus, who's a known mercenary and a genocidal maniac and a mass murderer,
mm-hmm.
and that this country loves to make him a hero, and they love to make murderers and mass murderers heroes. And I appreciate you letting us on the air, and appreciate free let
us. You have some other.
There's a couple of the inmates in here that also want to communicate with free radio listeners, and they have things to say in regards to
what's happening with them.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of people who are being railroaded in this place.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 5,000 inmates inside San Jose County Jail. There's 50% of them released from the drug war. We just got some literature that goes way into the drug war. But before we get to that, I wanted to encourage people that if they can, a few things. One, in terms of the case, if people agree that Christopher Columbus statue should have not been placed in City Hall and that they agree with what I did, I would like for people to call the mayor, Ron Gonzalez, and express their point of view with him.
Mm-hmm.
To get his phone number, you can call one of the supporters at 588-2756.
588-2756.
I'd also like to encourage people to come to a bail reduction hearing in a pretrial setting that's going to be on May 16th. We're trying to fill the courtroom because we know that the people will be the decisive factor in this case, whether I get prosecuted or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm being threatened with 8 years in jail. I'm looking at 2 felonies, 1 strike, and a hate crime for tearing down Christopher Columbus. I also wanted to...
I'd call it more of a love crime than a hate crime.
I hear that. I also wanted to promote that on May 26th. Well, actually, two things. Here on May 12th, there's a demonstration for Mumia Abu-Jamal, that courageous, heroic freedom fighter that they have locked down out in Philadelphia, out in Pennsylvania, who is a profound revolutionary and who's risking his life every day for the people of the world because he loves the people of the world and he wants people to be free. He's been on death row for 18 years. He's been wrongfully convicted of killing a police officer, in which the whole world knows that he did not do it. There's going to be a powerful demonstration of thousands up in San Francisco this Saturday, May 12th. I would encourage everybody to go out to it. Also on May 26th here in San Jose, there will be a demonstration of hundreds against called Rage Against Racism. There'll be many, many speakers, including six. If I may put in one last request before I turn the phone over to another inmate, mm-hmm. is that right now it took $2,000. They already stole $2,000 from me to get out once. Now they raised my bill to $70,000. But I'm asking people, we're hoping that we can get, or I'm hoping, consciously, that we can get 100 people to give $20 each, because that will raise the bail so that I can get out again. And the point of that is that if they keep me in this jail till trial, the chances are of them railroading me is very great. If I can get out to work in my defense, the chances that I can get a hung jury are very great. So I put it is in the people's hands, but I put it in the people's hands. And I wanted to turn over the phone now to a man who's been doing 2 years for about $40 worth of cocaine. And I think that's he's got an incredible story as well. And thank you very much, Robert, for taking the call.
Thank you, Jim Costner.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Steve.
Hey, Steve.
I just wanted to tell a story about me. And I was picked up about 4 years ago and for about a gram of coke.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still stuck in the system. I can't get out. I've been doing about 2 years, the last 4 years. And I already got released a month ago. I'm still waiting to get out, still waiting for a bed in a program.
So in other words, before you can get out, you have to actually get a drug treatment program bed?
Yes, I've been released last month, and I'm just waiting for a bed. It's been over another 6 weeks ago, and I'm still here.
Now, is the jail overcrowded? Are people sleeping on the floors and such?
Yes, it's overcrowded.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are you on, the mattresses are on other things than the usual facilities they're supposed to be on, or?
Yes, I'm supposed to get out with probation, and I'm supposed to be going to a drug program twice a week, an outpatient, and for some reason I'm still here.
Oh, perhaps it's time to file a nice lawsuit or for a writ of habeas corpus, perhaps.
Okay.
Just a thought. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that's my... I mean, if they're holding you illegally, and it sounds like they are, then you have to be demand to be taken before a judge.
Uh-huh. And I go see a judge every 45 days.
Right.
Like a drug court. And it's like the fourth time I've been to court already. Last time I was ordered released, I'm still here. I'm on a list of some kind.
Well, if you're ordered released, then they're in contempt of court by keeping you there, it would seem to me.
That's right, I feel.
How about the other prisoners? What percentage of the jail would you say is were you arrested for simply possessing, or were you selling, or were you beating people up while under the influence?
Drive down the street with my girlfriend, and we had a gram of stuff in the car, and I got picked up. They pulled us over.
What were you pulled over for?
I'm sorry?
What were you pulled over for?
We were pulled over for going too slow.
Going too slow?
Yeah, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were going too slow.
Why were you going too slow?
That's what they said.
I see.
I thought we were doing the speed limit 35.
Uh-huh.
I was just a passenger in the car.
And then they searched everybody, or?
They searched the whole car, tore it apart, and got a little bit of...
San Jose police, or? Mm-hmm. Do you think that was the driver racially different than the was he white, black?
They were white.
Mm-hmm. And, so it wasn't racial profiling.
They were just white. They worked with the DEA also.
No, I'm saying is the people in the car.
Oh, we were white.
You were white too.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay, go ahead. Okay. So. Is there anything you'd like to say to the Free Radio Santa Cruz audience now that you've got their ear?
Yes, don't get caught. But, if there's anybody out there that knows of an outpatient program that I can go to, or maybe give me a holler or something in here.
Yeah, you can give a call to the number. We'll give the number out for Jim's defense fund, and perhaps that he can convey that information to you. You know, I mean, the fact is California supposedly decriminalized in the sense that by this summer they're supposed to be sending people with, for example, heroin problems and in terms of first convictions to programs, period, not into jail at all. And I'm not aware that there's been any massive expansion of programs. So it looks to me like the state is ignoring this whole situation. They'd rather jail you than treat you is the deal. You got another inmate there that wants to talk?
Yes, I do.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Good evening.
Good evening. Who are you?
My name is Dave.
Hey, Dave.
And there's a couple things I want to read over the air.
Go ahead.
One is a poem from the book that James just referred to. This thing is like a wheel. It turns today, it's me. Tomorrow, it's you. Today, I'm hungry and firm. Tomorrow, it's you. Today, I'm hungry and firm. Tomorrow, it's you. Today, I'm indigent, homeless. Tomorrow, it's you.
sit wrongfully in prison. Tomorrow it's you. This thing is like a wheel. And just to give you a little background on me, I am a professional programmer, and I am now homeless. And I have absolutely no network left after having enough network to pay a server of about $100,000. The system has stolen everything from me. And you know what? I don't think any of it. I'm a free person. Freer person now with nothing than I ever was with all the crap that I have. And now I want to read something from the Bible. This is Acts. I have several attorneys that I'm trying to work with, but the problem is that I'm indigent right now. I have no money, and the attorney I have in Palo Alto is basically shining me on. And I've had a relationship with him, with Dan Barton, for 10 years, and I don't understand his behavior. So I have another attorney in San Francisco, and I'm trying to talk to him, and he's trying to talk to the people in Palo Alto and find out what they're doing.
So you haven't been convicted?
No, I have not been.
How long have you been in jail?
How long have I been in jail? Almost.
So you're a newbie in the jail cells.
That's correct.
What's your sense about the jail cells?
The people in here have more respect for each other and more caring for each other than the people on the outside. That's what I think.
Mostly white or black cell block?
It's fairly mixed. I would say it's probably mostly white. But the thing is that there are no racial animosities in here at all. It's unbelievable. And the outside world is so racist. It's ridiculous. I'm white, but my children are black. My ex-wife is black.
Mm-hmm.
And I love black people. And they've been screwed over so much by the system in this country that, you know, we're talking 500 years of oppression. You know, I'm trying to make a better world for my children. And I tried to make a better world for my ex-wife, but she wouldn't have any children.
Bummer.
Yeah, well, that's her problem.
How about Latinos? Lots of Hispanics in there?
There are a fair number of Latinos in there, quite a few, and a lot of them do not speak English very well, and I feel for them because they're really going to get hurt. They can't even understand what's going on.
I understand you have a third prisoner there who wants to say something.
Well, I am the third prisoner.
Oh, you are the third. Okay, well.
Do you want to talk to James again?
Sure. Why don't we sum up with him and thank you for coming on. Anything
you mentioned.
Yeah.
I look forward to meeting you in prison.
Okay. Sounds good.
Hey, thanks a lot, Robert, for letting me on.
Again, Jim, give us the number that people can call to get in touch with, either if they want to contribute to a bail fund or if they want to send a message.
Police brutality. It's to make sure that the Falon statute does not go up. It's to make sure that the Columbus statute does not go up. And it's basically to fight against racism in general. And actually what the man said earlier, he's talking about this particular cell in here, which is a 10-person cell. But this out of 5,000 people that's presently being held captive in this huge cage, the vast majority are Latino. The vast majority are Raza. The vast majority are brown. The vast majority, which you should look at that, because Latino people are native people. Latino people are indigenous people. They're aboriginal people, meaning that we live on our own homeland, and we're being treated like 10th-class citizens on our own homeland. And we are not going to accept this place. We are not going to accept slavery. We're not going to accept this reality. And that May 26th is largely about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in terms of police brutality in San Jose, this is the place where they killed a quadriplegic man in his own bed a little over a year ago. This is the place where they killed Danny Garcia outside of his own home. This is the place where they've killed 11 innocent people. The pigs have murdered 11 innocent people in a little over a year's time. And they've gotten away with it. Not one of those pigs has been brought up on charges. But the reality is that people in here, for just defending themselves, are doing mass time. This shows you the hypocrisy of the system. This shows you the contradiction between the oppressor and the oppressed. The oppressor, the oppressed can get beaten up and brutalized and exploited and treated like dogs all day long, and they can get away with it. But if the oppressor stands up, but if the oppressed stands up, we get thrown in jail. This whole prison is nothing about correcting behavior. It has nothing to do with rehabilitation. It has nothing to do with stopping crime. It is the crime. This is an extension of the crime. This cage is here to keep the slaves in place, to keep them in check. If the slave decides that he wants to be free, this is the place where you'll go. And this is the reality of America. The whole notion that this is a free society is totally bankrupt. It's a huge lie. It's a 500-year lie. It's a 200-year lie. We need to understand the truth. We need to promote the truth. We need to really care about each other. We need to stick up for each other. We need to speak out. We need to organize. We need to fight. It's our only hope. This system is coming down really rapidly. We were just reading the reports today that we got from another inmate that comes from the November Coalition that monitors prison rights and monitors cages throughout this country. There's over 32 cages in California state alone right now that has over a quarter million human beings that are presently living in cages in California alone. There's over 2,010,000 human beings that are locked down throughout the country. 1 million of them are black. There's over 4,500 people on death row, which 60% is people of color. And they're building these prisons faster than schools and hospitals throughout the country. And in terms of this particular situation, the prison industrial complex is the number one growth industry in this country. There's many ways that these people make money, talking about the ruling class, but the three main ways that these people make money is building prisons, selling arms and guns and nuclear bombs, and selling drugs. Those are the three principal ways that this ruling class, Uncle Chan, accumulates money. Do these three things, which are all crooked. There's people in here doing time for drugs, but the CIA is running around the country, running around the world, selling tons of cocaine.
It seems to me the only way that, entry-level folks who are poor can get in the drug rackets. You know, I mean, you can't, arms are somewhat more, difficult. They have different, more difficult connections. You know, building prisons, you got to be a contractor and an architect and have a connection with the unions and so forth. But to sell drugs, it's somewhat easier because the market is everywhere and the whole thing is criminal and, it's a growth industry. And that's why you have so many people in jail for that, because it's really an economic kind of crime.
The November Coalition put out in its document that we're going through today that there's been over seven. This is written a little while ago. There was over 700,000 human beings that have been arrested on drug offenses, and right now, in terms of the prison population, that's anywhere between 60% and 75% of the inmate population in this country alone is because of the drug war, the so-called drug war, which is really not a war on drugs. It's a war on poor people. It's a war on the community.
Well, I would say the number is even greater, because my understanding is that there were 750,000 people arrested last year for marijuana.
Wow.
Not just drugs. And marijuana is a relatively innocuous drug, though some people do have difficulties with it because they get habituated to it or have dependency problems still. It's certainly non-lethal compared to the killing qualities of alcohol and, of course, the vicious, the lethal qualities of tobacco, which are big business.
What you just said is the November Coalition, I think it's from Patreon. The first thing they say,
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Only 1 minute. The first thing they say is war on drugs, like prohibition, a failure. It said the Capital Times editorialized that the crack menace is the most serious drug threat this nation's ever faced. Well, no. If you want to talk about what drug causes the most damage, it's clearly alcohol. And we've known that since 1776. Tobacco runs a strong second. However, the most serious drug threat is not any chemical at all. It's the anti-drug laws themselves.
Hear ya. Anything you want to say finally in the last 30 seconds, Jim?
Free political prisoners, stop police brutality, turn the tide of repression, respect all human beings, respect the earth, love God, and do what's right.
And, hey, keep your powder dry and stay warm in those cold cells there, Jim.
You have 15 seconds left to talk.
And they're for you. Go ahead, Jim.
Also, the conditions in here are really foul. Really, really foul. They wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning for breakfast. They feed you. There's bed mice in here. They give people bumps on their arms. There's some Nazis running around in the...
And that was Jim Costner calling collect from the Santa Clara County Jail, where he currently awaits trial on charges of vandalism, hate enhancement, because he smashed the statue of famed mass murderer Christopher Columbus, which was standing previously in the San Jose City Hall.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Mike Tomasi.
Hey, Mike.
I've been listening about this idiot Columbus and all this ridiculous crap that's going on in the court. And you know something? Last city council meeting that I went to, I brought an Easter basket to the city hall,
mm-hmm,
full of stones.
Right.
Because you're Mr. What's the name, the Jew?
Mayor Fitzmaurice?
No, the Jew. Who's the Jew?
I don't know if they're...
Ivan?
Well, let's see, the city council consists of... There's this council...
No, wait, let me explain this to you.
Yes.
See, okay, this Jew said to the city council...
Oh, you're talking about the Rabbi Levin?
Yes, my friend. He's my friend. Excuse me, I can't remember his name.
That's okay.
But anyway, this man said he'd throw stones at Jesus, that this town would. Well, you want to know something? I want Free Radio to know that they did throw stones at Jesus right at me, because I claim that every person that walks this earth, male, female, animals, insects, they're all Jesus. Jesus is the soul of man. He's a spirit. Now, the hidden internal affair of all of mankind doesn't have nothing to do with Jesus, Buddha, or anybody else. But I'll tell you what, Mr. Sugar threw stones at Jesus.
You're talking about Councilmember Sugar.
The city council, the mayor, Mr. Henning, the police department, Mr. Blanchard, what's the chief of police's name?
Belcher, Steve Belcher.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Belcher's there. I went and I made the complaint. I tried to make a citizen's arrest because, buddy, I'll tell you, Jesus is not going to be stoned. He is not going to have any kind of roses, stickers stuck in his head. He's going to come back and he's going to kick out. You understand me?
Thank you, Michael.
Hey, wait, let me finish, okay?
Go ahead.
Because this is really important.
Do it quickly.
But I went to the police department and I tried to make a citizen's arrest on Mr. Keith Sugar. Now, these cops, they've been talking about it for over a week now. Now, why can't I make a citizen's arrest? Now, I want you. You have more knowledge on this.
Well, you're talking about Councilmember Sugar. You have to be able to charge him with a crime, misdemeanor.
I did charge him with a crime.
What crime?
Crime was assault.
And he assaulted me. And how did he assault you?
He threw stones at me.
When did he do this?
He did this at the city council meeting when you were kneeling between the chairs trying to avoid my presence.
He threw a stone at you?
He threw a stone at me.
Really? I shouldn't have been kneeling. I mean, he actually threw a physical stone at you during a city council meeting.
He threw a stone at me, and it was not a physical stone. It was a mental stone.
That's not considered an assault. That's considered...
That is an assault.
Well, maybe an insult, but it isn't an assault. At least it's... I mean, you were... Let's put it this way. He was expressing his opinion rather than actually menacing you with something that might actually hurt you. See, that's the reason...
But, you see, he hurt me not outside.
He hurt you in your heart.
No, my heart? Hell no.
No. Well,
you see, the thing that these people don't have is this thing called communication. If they would communicate with each other, they wouldn't have this problem.
I can't agree with you more. I think the city council has no interest in communicating with the community whatsoever.
The only thing that they want to do is put money in their pockets and to laugh at people like you, Mr. Norris, and people like me.
I think that they get a giggle out of us, and I think it's unfortunate that the community doesn't stand up and do something independently, the city council.
No,
I hope so.
And I'll tell you what, everybody's going to stand up because you know something?
Well, they may stand up, but I'm going to hang up, so you've got 10 seconds, man.
Okay, they cannot have absolute rule over the people, and they can't make people afraid of them because the people will rebel against them. And as far as that Columbus dude goes, he was an asshole anyway. I'm an Italian, and I don't believe in people like that. I don't believe in Mussolini either.
Good for you, man.
Bye.
Thank you.
That was Michael Tomasi, who tried to force me to pledge allegiance to the flag at the last city council meeting without success. I'm not a man to pledge allegiance to the flag until there actually is liberty and justice for all. But I believe Michael Tomasi is a man who does believe in liberty and justice for all, and I commend him for what he tries to do, although I don't share a lot of his views. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. We're going into the last 35 minutes of the show, and I'm going to try to get on the line. Let's see who's going to be getting the wrath of Norris here. Well, we'll just see who's home. Could be you. So if your phone is ringing, watch out.
Hello, Fred Geiger.
Hey, Robert.
Hey. Well, we're on the line now, live with you, Fred Geiger.
Try to mellow that out.
You've gotten out of your bathtub and you've, put on the necessary clothing to talk to people on free radio?
There are necessary clothing for that?
Well, we don't want you to be, exposed unduly.
Well, I'll just try to keep myself secreted in the psychological level.
Now, Fred, you are a man who has regular meetings with the shitty council, as I so adolescently call them.
Never more than three at once, Robert.
Well, there you go. Good point. The Brown Act, which the council so, of course, intimately and accurately respects, that's, of course, the law that says you can only have a... If you're going to have a council meeting, you have to let people know about it and give them a chance to hear what's actually going on, something that the council tends to avoid doing, but theoretically is obliged to do. You, on the other hand, have, monthly constituent meetings with council members, at least three of them?
Yeah, it's basically a continuation of the campaign staff of the various progressive candidates that have continued to meet with them.
Now, we're talking Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar? Are we talking Porter and Riley?
Or? We're talking Porter, Riley, Crone, and Sugar.
I got you. A four. This could be a Brown Act violation.
Not all at once, as I said.
Not all at once. Oh, dear. Here I was, rubbing my hands, hopefully. Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a certain controversy around town regarding George Au and Barry Swenson and labor practices. Well, Swenson, of course, is getting picketed all over town for substandard wages, and yet the council is sort of shoveling over projects to him. What do you make of this,
well,
Fred?
Well, I've talked to some of the council members about that, some of the progressive ones, and they're not happy about the possibility of having a contractor who's being picketed working on a city project.
Are they voting against
so
it?
I hope that they're going to find an out so this won't happen. I know they're concerned about it.
Hmm. Well, of course, there's some concerns. I'd hope to have a more militant and informed individual grill you thoroughly, because the rumor has it that you are, as we put it, soft on scabs, and I want you to dispel this rumor.
Soft on scabs.
Yes.
I'd like to discuss that with the person making the accusation.
Well, I will try to get Mr. Graham in the studio by the scuff of the neck here and make him fess up. He's saying that there's a big scam being planned to pass on to Au and Swenson the Del Mar Theater, so they can have essentially, under the claim that they're going to be creating a community arts center, they're actually getting a private deal, whereas a real community arts center is being actually done at the Rio Theater, some blocks away, under private auspices. But
yeah, it looks like they're doing an art center thing there. As far as the scab thing, yeah, I mean, I have worked to oppose Barry Swenson, especially while he's being picketed, having any work that the city has money involved in. And like I said, I think that's been worked out. I hope it's been worked out. And I expect that it will be if it hasn't.
Are the unions pissed at you, Fred? That's what I'm hearing. I haven't talked to any union reps, so I can't say so. But
I've never heard a person. Well, I don't understand what the accusation is.
That you are trying to play both sides against the middle in the sense that you're
trying to get a contract
on
the Del Mar Hotel.
That you are
figured.
You're soft peddling things to the city council because for your interest in maintaining good communications with them instead of, shall we say, reading them the riot act.
Well, my communication has been very clear as far as having a contractor being picketed on that job. It would be a disaster. It would be unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've listened. So, like I say, I hope the result will be a good one.
Hmm. Well, I'm, of course, not in a position to be able to carry this struggle further in terms of, you know, challenging anything you're saying or, you know, confirming anything you're saying, because I'm essentially ignorant on a lot of these issues, and I wish I had a person with more knowledge in the studio, but I'm glad that you are coming clean here in a public fashion so that we can later, should we say, nail you if, in fact, there are those who claim that your statements don't cover the situation.
Truth, Robert, I think I'm the person who took the lead on this issue, and if it is resolved, which I believe it is, led to, it's going in a direction that ultimately resolved it.
This issue being, what, the Del Mar Theater?
On the Del Mar Theater, yeah.
Right. So what's actually, where are we at in the Del Mar Theater process?
Well,
are they planning to hand this plum to Au and Swenson? Or?
I'm under the belief that Swenson's not going to be the contractor there while he's being picketed. That's all I know.
And what leads you to this belief?
I've just been assured by various council members that they realize that there would be a mistake and they don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. And you believe those assurances?
I don't know that they're wrong. I hope they're right.
These are the same council members who talked about safe sleeping zones and guarantees for the Dolphin Lee tenants and things of that sort, right?
We'll find out, Robert.
Well, no, are they the same council members who made those guarantees, or are we talking different council members?
Most of them have made those guarantees at various times.
Said that they would like to have those guarantees, but then, of course, didn't vote for them when the push came to shove.
Well, I'm hoping that those, if you want to change the subject a little to the Dolphin Lee, I'm hoping that, you know, all the stuff that they put out that, you know, you and other people
Why would you have to hope? All you need to do is put it into specific legislation, as was mandated by the SCAN resolution of May 31st, which has never been done by the city council. So why would you hope?
I don't want to put this personally on you, but I think possibly it might just be that they don't want to put it in writing to take a slap at you.
It's my fault, yes. Well, I have to admit that I will take responsibility for that, but wouldn't this indicate to those who have promised to do this that their promises seem to be worth about as much as, untreated sewage? I mean, I'm wondering why you would regard their promises on the Del Mar as more substantial than around the Dolphin Lee or the Sleeping Band.
I don't really know if all or any of them promised that they would put that in writing. I don't remember that happening.
I remember Sugar talking about guarantees endlessly. I remember Crone talking about guarantees, and I think that if the two of those took any lead in asking for guarantees, you would get the rest of the council, perhaps with the exception of Fitzmaurice, to, you know, jump right on board. Similarly with the sleeping ban, if any member of the council brought up anything around the sleeping ban, I think everyone would have to do something. They might not do everything that everyone wanted, but it is an issue that has been so thoroughly discussed that to vote it down would be impossible in some sense. But not in your constituent meetings, apparently, Fred. You don't bring that one up, I take it.
Yeah, that's definitely been brought up. Yeah. I can't say it's going anywhere, but it's been brought up.
Right, have you brought it up yourself?
I can't remember every meeting over the last 3 years.
Really? How about the last 3 months?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Well, you know, it's of course the people in the middle that get the shit, and that's, you know, the folks who are holding those meetings with the men and women in power, and you are, of course, one of those people, and yet you have the courage to come on the air and talk about it, and I think, as you've suggested, the reason you do this is the more I diss you, the higher your political capital goes.
I don't need any political capital, Robert. I'm not available for any office.
I see.
But that was just to get you to take a look, perhaps, at your tactics.
Uh-huh. Well, no, I mean, I have to be, you know, provide you with backup in my own sort of backhanded way, right?
All right, I guess I'll accept that.
Mm.
One thing I do want to talk about is this, as you probably know, you didn't stay at the scan meeting until the end, but one of the three issues that was voted on is the concern of the year and area to be worked on, other than the housing crisis and the council election rules and practices, was the Tidelands issue. And I think there's a new swelling up of emotion.
This is the long 2.5 year delayed Tidelands issue, where City Attorney Barisone, who should have been dumped, and could have been dumped by a 4-3 majority at any time, still maintains his death grip on the city's legal system. Is that the situation?
I'm not sure what he maintains now on this issue, anyway, because they subbed this out, which was one of the good things that they did after the previous election. To an attorney, I think, recommended by Celia Scott, who seemed to be somewhat more interested in a different resolution other than giving 80% of the contested.
But I keep hearing from the Tidelands people that nothing is being done around this issue. Is this just merely a bunch of radicals raging in the wind, or in fact, are they correct? Is nothing being done?
I think there has been some stuff done, but I think it's time to go further than the
I see.
Mm-hmm. Negotiation that has been what's been going on at this point,
mm-hmm.
because I don't think it's produced this a settlement that we could be happy with, or else it would.
Don't you think that something could have been done in the first 3 months after Crone and
Sher- I don't know how long a timetable is.
Well, we're 2.5 years later. I mean,
yeah, I agree. 2.5 years is too long, and I think it's time for the.
Aren't 2.5 months too long? I mean, one has to understand the situation, because if you use these kind of temporizing comments, which you are so fond of, then I think you lose sight of the reality of what's really going on, and you inspire in people a false sense of hope in council members who need, in fact, to be bounced down the road instead of indulged. Now, you know. You have to. I mean, is 2.5 years? 2.5 years is too long.
I
but
think
is,
it's too long. Yeah.
Is 2.5 months too long, Fred?
I don't know. I probably think 2.5 months isn't too long because of the negotiating and whatever they're.
Well, they had 2.5 months. How about 5 months? Was that too long?
I don't know, Robert. I'm not an attorney. I don't have all the facts.
Yeah, but you're a man who
wait,
throws.
Wait a minute. Yeah. I get to talk when I get to talk, and you get to talk. When
well,
I'm
you're cutting me off on this,
no,
though. You
cut
know.
Me off. That's fine.
If you want to come talk directly to some Huff activists, I'm one of them. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Peace and Freedom Party and Huff and others are jointly endorsing and sponsoring an evening about the sleeping ban and its links with other issues such as police brutality, rent control, and UCSC policies around that destroy housing. Affordable housing, or I should say subsidized housing projects that are essentially eating up all affordable housing funds but don't really provide more affordable housing than they destroy, all kinds of sort of links that we really haven't looked at very closely around the issue of this crazy Santa Cruz law, the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, which makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep outside or in a vehicle or in any structure that is not a house or hotel between the hours of 11 and 8:30 and provides for a $54 fine for doing so. So, in the last few minutes of the show, I'm going to read a little bit of a flyer that I'm going to present at the Green Party Homeless Working Group meeting today at 132 Matson Street, for those who are interested out in Live Oak. If you really think you want to go to this thing, I would suggest showing up at the town clock at 2, although the meeting won't actually happen till 4. I can, again, give you directions, and if there are enough people who want to go, I'll perhaps do a caravan and try to clean out my car. Boy, that would be a big job, but we'll see. This is Fitzmaurice's Sleeping Band record by Becky Johnson and myself. It was originally written back in February, and it was updated, well, three times since, and I'll begin to read it here. In the early 90s, the Green Party of the state of California made ending anti-homeless sleeping bans explicitly a part of its platform, according to longtime Green Party activist David Silva. The local Green Party lobbying efforts added ending the criminalization of homelessness to the platform. In 1997, activists filed the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban, which the Green Party of Santa Cruz voted to endorse. And, of course, Municipal Code 6.36 is the camping ordinance, which in effect bans camping citywide except in backyards and fenced-in side yards. It prohibits setting up tents and camping equipment and maintaining a campsite. Municipal Code 6.36.010A is the sleeping ban section, which actually bars the act of sleeping after 11 p.m. And this is the verbatim wording of that section. But unfortunately, we'll have to wait because we have the public calling in.
Front Free Radio.
Well, on with the show. Sleeping, 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. To sleep at any time between the hours of 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. in any of the following places is specifically prohibited. Outdoors, with or without bedding, tent, hammock, or other similar protection or equipment. 2. In, on, or under any structure not intended for human occupancy, whether with or without bedding, tent, hammock, or other similar protection or equipment. And this, of course, includes any building that is not a domicile. That is what we discovered in court in 1988. And 3, in, on, or under any parked vehicle, including an automobile, bus, truck, camper, trailer, or recreational vehicle. That is, it is illegal to sleep in your own recreational vehicle on any public street or in any driveway in Santa Cruz except under the 72 hours and get out of town exception that Fitzmaurice passed back in 1999. That's the sleeping ban, which the Green Party in Santa Cruz voted to endorse an initiative to repeal that sleeping ban. It would have legalized, the initiative would have legalized sleeping outside or in vehicles in nearly 40% of the city. It would have allowed the city council to ban sleeping at night in residential and oceanfront areas. It did not legalize sleeping in parks at night or legalize lying down in the downtown area. And that failed to get on the ballot. In 1998, through the Santa Cruz County Greens lobbying efforts, the Green Party of the state of California specifically voted to call for the end of criminalization of homelessness in general and the end of sleeping bans in particular, now a plank of the Green Party of California. And there's a website for the Green Party, which is Santa Cruz Green Party, all one word, .org. In 1998, the Greens and other progressives endorsed Fitzmaurice for city council. Fitzmaurice said that during that campaign that he opposed ticketing people for sleeping. Successful city council candidates Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar committed themselves to meaningful action to decriminalize sleeping, which they shortly thereafter attempted, I should say Crone and Sugar did, over Fitzmaurice's opposition. In December of 1998, Fitzmaurice abandoned Crone and Sugar and voted down their motion to not ticket sleepers unless an identifiable health or safety hazard existed. In February 1999, the council voted Fitzmaurice's proposal to allow one vehicle with homeless occupants to sleep in the driveway of a private residence with the written permission of both the property owner and the tenant for only 3 days in any calendar month. Fitzmaurice got the idea from a car can be parked on a city street for up to 72 hours. The law he proposed without input or discussion from homeless people advocates or Green Party input. One activist called it the 72 hours and get out of town law. This change, incidentally, legalizes middle-class people inviting grandma and her Winnebago in the driveway for a short visit, but really doesn't help homeless people at all. Few renters dare ask their landlord for written permission to allow someone to sleep in a car on their property, even if no one else would object. 3 days is a cruel joke when the average homeless person spends 4 months on the street before finding housing. According to the Homeless Census 2000, a needs assessment survey conducted in Santa Cruz County last year by United Way, there is much, that's where that figure comes from. There's much interesting and surprising information in this study, which is available at the Community Action Board, 457-1741. The Green Party platform says that those who aid homeless people should not be legally prohibited from acts of charity and providing shelter, food, or other assistance. Abolish anti-sleeping laws, especially in areas which don't have adequate open space, shelter, and sleeping areas for the homeless, is paragraph 6 under homelessness, page 43 of the Green Party of the State of California platform. Period. In January 2000, activists circulated a second voter initiative to decriminalize sleeping, which then-Vice Mayor Fitzmaurice declined to sign. In fall of 1999 and later in the spring of 2000, City Council first ignored, then dumped, the Homeless Issues Task Force recommendations one by one. One recommendation was to repeal the entire camping ban, not just the sleeping ban sections of that law, as fatally flawed. Another emergency Homeless Issues Task Force recommendation was to suspend giving sleeping and camping tickets until safe zones could be established. Fitzmaurice let these recommendations die and proposed no meaningful alternatives. In May 2000, Fitzmaurice voted to open safe zones in the industrial areas for nighttime homeless sleeping. At 1 a.m. in late June, on an item improperly agendized, he did not object to a questionable vote that killed the zones before they had even been opened because of a propaganda campaign from police and conservative businesses. Fitzmaurice never initiated or supported an investigation into those charges. In June 2000, Fitzmaurice made no objection when Green Party activist David Silva was dragged away in handcuffs by police in a false arrest to Dominican psychiatric ward for allegedly being a danger to himself. This was on June 13, 2000. Silva had suggested some days before that public immolation might be needed before City Council would keep its commitments around the sleeping ban, such as, let's say, Buddhist monks did in Vietnam when they burned themselves alive in protest against the killing that was going on there. He apologized, that is, David Silva apologized shortly after the suggestions were made. He was arrested anyway without evidence, warrant, or justification in the midst of a key City Council meeting because of his sleeping ban activism. And by arrested, we mean taken into psychiatric custody on a 5150 hold. In July, Fitzmaurice proposed a ballot initiative which would have legalized sleeping out of doors on the ground, but criminalized occupancy of a vehicle on public property between 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. This actually was worse language than currently exists in the sleeping ban, at least during that period of time. When activists quickly convened to propose alternate language that they could support, Fitzmaurice supplied the key vote to table the proposal without debate, ensuring that nothing got on the ballot in November. That was the last the council even discussed the sleeping ban. That was last summer. Fitzmaurice would not raise the issue of sleeping ban repeal in the fall elections, even though it was a Green Party requirement for endorsement. Though organizations and the public brought it up at virtually every election forum, Fitzmaurice remained completely silent. All he needed was one more council vote to pass the safe sleeping zones killed in July. He got that vote. In fact, some think he got two votes, maybe even three, but then, and so far, has refused to use it. In December 2000, two to three people waited peacefully and legally in his public waiting room to persuade him to agendize the sleeping ban or some meaningful alternative. Fitzmaurice threatened peaceful activists, ordered them to leave, and then prompted his aide to get a restraining order banning the three leaders. That's the City Council coffee clutch affair. On December 21st, the Homeless Services Center Memorial read the names of 41 homeless people who died in 2000 in Santa Cruz County. By May 1st, at least another six had died. In January 2001 at Council, Fitzmaurice initiated decorum rules that penalized pro-homeless media, such as not allowing handheld tape recorders to be operated at the podium and barring face-on videoing of speakers from behind the dais. He began interrupting homeless rights speakers, refusing them the time to speak, and even removing them. In February 2001, Fitzmaurice blocked Councilmember Porter's proposed discussion of the sleeping ban. Fitzmaurice also ignored repeated requests that Council direct staff to find safe sleeping sites and shelter buildings as requested in the April 2000 Sugar Memo and the unanimous July 2000 City Council resolution. In February 2001, Fitzmaurice denied a legitimate claim against the city by Green Party activist David Silva concerning